Welcome to the Esri and the Science of Wear podcast. James Fallow's books have won awards. He wrote speeches for President Jimmy Carter. As a correspondent for the New York Times and the Atlantic, he brings the world to his audience. Most of his writing career has been monitoring and anticipating change. Now, he's written the introduction to a book by a childhood friend, Jack Dangerman, the founder of Esri. Dangerman's book, called The Power of Wear, describes his journey as a pioneer of geographic information systems and how GIS is integral to taking on the world's biggest challenges. Fallows calls it a catalytic technology.
The story of important breakthroughs in our era is that they represent progress in all sorts of areas, reinforcing one another. It's a moment where Esri is both combining different technologies and making other technologies possible.
James Fallows talks with Esri's chief marketing officer, Mariana Cantor, about the power of wear.
Jim, hello, and welcome to the Esri and the Science of Wear podcast.
Mariana, it is great to be with you again.
You and Jack Dangerman, Esri's founder and president, go a long way back. You both grew up in Redlands, California, where Esri's headquartered. Redlands is a small remote town with a population of around 70,000 people, and I'm sure much smaller when you were growing up. Yet, in the same generation, it produced a widely respected thought leader, writer, and journalist, you, and the multi-billionaire technology entrepreneur, Jack. Is this a coincidence? Was there something unique about growing up in Redlands?
I think that Redlands was, like many parts of America, a sort of a place where lots of people with ambitions or stars in their eyes decided, this is where I'm from and I'd like to see other places too.
Jack just wrote a book called The Power of Wear, A Geographic Approach to the World's Greatest Challenges, and you wrote an introduction to that book. What drew you to this topic, and what was your message?
So what drew me to this book by Jack and to the work of Esri over the decades now was the idea that this was really Jack's magnum opus of things he's been spending his entire life so far working on, having a number of collaborators from Esri and from friends of Esri pitching in there as well. And I think that with each successive release of the software, with each successive user conference, Jack has had a more and more unified field theory of why GIS matters to the world. And I think this book really puts it together in a way he's been thinking about for a long time. So I was glad to see that. The point I made in a somewhat labored way in the intro was essentially that there are certain kinds of technologies on which, in a way, people stop noticing because they're everywhere. When electricity was first becoming distributed a century and a half ago, oh boy, we had electricity. When I worked for Jimmy Carter as a candidate for president back in 1976, he would get cheers across the South by having them remember, as he did, when electricity had first come to their town and they didn't have to use these candles or gas lamps or whatever. But nobody thinks about electricity now except when it goes out. And I think that GIS is becoming the same kind of universal technology where everything else is connected to it. And I think just one of the other thing, that the story of important breakthroughs in our era is that they represent progress in all sorts of areas, reinforcing one another. Harold Varmus, the Nobel Prize winner, former head of the NIH, used to say that genome technology, which he got his Nobel Prize in, essentially couldn't happen without modern computers. And I think that it's a combination now of sensors and visualizations and all kinds of AI tools and all the rest. So it's a moment where Esri is both combining different technologies and making other technologies possible.
Let's talk a little more about that. There is this idea that we talk about at Esri that geography, whereas the technology of GIS is based on, is a profound science because it's both content and context. How do you understand that sort of relationship and significance?
Each of them has the kind of duality you mentioned, where they are technologies and organizing tools. There are timelines, just as there are spatial references for everything in wear terms. but also there is content to all of them. More obviously when it comes to geography than to time, which has no sort of corporeal existence. But geography, it both has become more and more a tool, a technology for understanding where things are, how they're connected, how commerce flows, how people flow, how pollutants either flow or are corrected, plus the content of what it is like on the west coast of Africa, what it is like in Antarctica, what it is like in the Mojave Desert of California. So I think that is one of the great powers of where and of geography. And I will concede the point to Jack that when doesn't have the same, that is purely an organizing concept as opposed to actual content.
Would you say that because the world's becoming increasingly more complex and interconnected, that this visualization and the model of the physical world we live in through GIS and other tools is so important for us to be able to live within it effectively and efficiently?
I agree with that. And also in the meta sense, I think you can view most important technological breakthroughs over the millennia as being ways to make things simpler and clearer. The invention of alphabets and printed language as opposed to hieroglyphics or scratches in the sand, that is something which made things clearer. I once did a long article for The Atlantic years ago about the most important technological breakthroughs since the wheel, and very high on the list was simply reading glasses, because that made basically half of humanity certainly was able to read in ways they had not been able to do before. And so I think that the visualization tools of maps in general, which make things, it's the old picture is worth a thousand words principle, and a map is worth a thousand pictures, of you can suddenly say, aha, I see where this is, how they're connected, this is bigger, this is smaller. So yes, I think it's a very important visualization tool.
In this book, the book by Jack, he talks about his aha moment, which struck me actually, of seeing, and he was very young. He was actually flying on a plane from returning somewhere to his hometown of Redlands, and he had this aha moment of seeing land from a plane. And suddenly he says he saw the connections. He saw the landscape as a system of systems, agricultural systems, topographic system, vegetation systems, and so on. He went on to build a technology, the one we're talking about, GIS, which essentially digitizes and visualizes this physical world as a system. You're a pilot. Would you agree with this different perspective that you get from a different vantage point? And how does it affect your perceptions of the world?
I very much agree with that. And I was glad to read that part of Jack's book right in the very beginning, I think, when he's talking about the origins of his career. As a side note, I will never understand people who have the window shade down when they're on an airplane trip.
Me too.
No, for millennia, people have ached to see the world from above, and these people are rolling down the shade, et cetera. And I think that one of the reasons I have loved for the past 30 plus years flying small airplanes is that you have a much more sort of GIS type view of the world from 2,000 feet than from 30,000 feet. From 30,000 feet, you can't see the details. From 2,000 or 3,000 feet, it's like being in a sort of mobile skyscraper with you on the top of it, a skyscraper that's moving at 100 miles an hour. And so it is really wonderful. So yes, I never tire of seeing the world from above.
Do you believe that technology and data can help bring people together? And if so, how?
So yes, comma, but. I think the story of every single technology, and to wallow in cliche, is tool for good and evil. Alfred Nobel was inventing explosives, and John D. Rockefeller had the blessing and the curse of beginning the modern oil industry and all the rest. And so I think that something that strikes me about GIS technology right now is the balance between good and evil seems more heavily on the good side than in most other technologies you can think of. I give credit to the community of GIS people, as fostered deliberately by Esri, I think, to take some responsibility for the tools they're creating and find ways to have people understand their shared environmental challenges, their shared resource challenges, border issues, you name it. I think it has tried to have this be a responsible and, on balance, very positive technology.
So you and your wife, Deborah Fellows, wrote about communities across the U.S., and we talked about that book. It's a fantastic book. It's called Our Towns, A 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America. And you've also written there about the powerful concept of place. You've also explored the importance of cities and entrepreneurs and the symbiotic relationship between community and business. Could you talk about all that and also the importance of place?
Thanks for asking. So this was for the many listeners who may not be aware. So starting about 10 years ago, my wife Deb and I began traveling in our little propeller plane, flown by me and navigated by Deb, to smaller places around the country, initially to see what's happening in Holland, Michigan, what's happening in Eastport, Maine, and cumulatively as time went on to say that there's a difference in the perspective of the United States you get mainly from the national news, which is not always uplifting or calming or making you think there's a reasonable grounds for compromise among people, and the perspective from most local areas where most parts of the country people felt the America they experienced firsthand was doing okay. And the America they heard about or read about seemed to be in terrible trouble. And one of the keys to what made communities work, and we were in a lot of diverse ones from Mississippi to Idaho to Central Valley, California to Rust Belt, Pennsylvania, or whatever, is the ones that had some coherence is where people thought there was there was a place they were from. Their responsibility didn't end at their own front door. They had some responsibility for what the rest of the community was doing. Would younger people want to move back there or to move there? What was it going to be like in terms of the hospitals in 10 years? What were the rivers going to be like? So I think that there is a human sense of place, of belonging and feeling as if this landscape, these people, this dialect, all these other things, they feel comfortable to me. And communities that succeeded, we thought, found ways just to inculcate the idea that you are in Wausau, Wisconsin, and it's a particular culture, and we welcome you and help us build it. And so that sense of place, I think, really matters.
Let's talk about something you've been doing and very good at, communication. You've been communicating your entire long and illustrious career as a national correspondent for The Atlantic, as a speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter, you mentioned, as an author of many books. So what are the tenets of effective communication?
It is, I'm going to buy myself a moment here for this interesting question, which I haven't considered in exactly this way, by saying that a teacher I had at Redlands High School who made a big difference in my life, one of several there, was a wonderful woman named Gertrude Backus. And she taught speech classes at Redlands, and she was the coach of the debate team and the oratory team. And many people who went to Redlands High felt as if that was the changing experience in their life to have been through Mrs. Backus's speech courses. And she would say that the route to a speech was, you know, you would collect ideas, you'd select ideas, you would organize the ideas, and then you would write them out. I remember this 60 years later of the way she would lay out these principles. And what this comes to for me is the most important thing in any kind of communication, whether designed to be read on a page or designed to be heard or seen on a screen, is knowing yourself what you want to say. And if you can't for your own self write down the one sentence, I'm going to tell you about this, then you're going to have a very hard time having any of your readers or listeners understand the destination you're trying to get to. So I think the most important thing is just being clear on what you want to say. For 20 plus years, I had the blessing of working at The Atlantic for a man named William Whitworth, who died recently in his late 80s. He was the editor of the magazine for about 20 years after being an outstanding editor of The New Yorker before that. And he said that a failing many people who are writing for fancy publications like The Atlantic or The New Yorker or writing books would do is they would feel as if metaphorically they had to put on a three-piece suit and become very formal and say, in recent years, this or that. And he said, just tell me what you want to say. Just start out the article by saying, here's what I wondered about. Here's what I asked. Here's what I found out. Let me tell you why. So I think that the simpler and the clearer clarity in your own mind is indispensable. And then clarity in a non-clumsy way to the audience is the execution part of that. Something that's an underappreciated reality of the writing life and to a degree the speaking life too is that once the audience is no longer high school or college students, they don't have to listen to you. Nobody, you can't make them read what you write. You can't make them come to your speech. You have to make it interesting to them. You have to find a way to say, here is something that's going to be worth your having heard, you know, having spent these few minutes reading, having spent these few minutes listening to. So you have to have clarity in your own mind. And I think it is a hard challenge. And it takes us back to the realm of tool for good or evil, because human beings usually understand most effectively through stories and narrative, not always. And there are times where a list can itself be a kind of story and a proof can be a kind of story. But that is a basic human way of understanding, as maps are a basic way of human understanding, and pictures and inoculation against the spread of false narratives, which have always been there, other than trying to have more of the true narratives and recognizing the importance of that form, that not every kind of communication has to be telling a story. It's usually the case that an audience will remember at most two things from any presentation. And facing that reality when you're preparing a speech is an important thing to do, because that we know in our role as listeners, you remember a thing or two. It's worth remembering that as a speaker. They're going to remember a thing or two. Often I will start a speech by saying, I'd like you to remember two things from this presentation, and here they are. So I think just recognizing that it's important to develop the tools of storytelling and other communication and question asking and map making and photo taking and all the rest, because there will be dark side versions of all these, and we can't will that away. We can only cope with it.
You mentioned that typically a person can remember just two things from a speech, let's say, and it's really important to understand your own message and to have clarity around delivering that message. So it's what I would call is all that is function, like this is the content of the thing. But I'm also interested in the interplay between form and function, delivery and content. Of course, a charismatic delivery coupled with compelling content is the ideal. But what is the feeling that you would want your audience to walk away from a speech with, even if they can't remember the two things? And how do you achieve that?
For the many members of the listenership, probably all of them, who've given public presentations themselves, the most important conceptual step is to recognize that your tone has to seem true to you. There are politicians, for example, where you can tell when they're reading from the teleprompter and then going off script because they sound entirely different. When they're reading from the teleprompter, it's like they're reading some old textbook, and then the real person comes through. Sound like the real person the entire time. And it can be more, there are more and less formal versions of the real person that any of us has in his or her repertoire. But the main thing is to sound like yourself. And for people in the audience who may be speechwriters, as I did at some times in my career, that's the most important thing too, to have it sound not like you, but by the person who's going to be giving it. And part of the skill of being a speechwriter is having an ear, like an ear for dialect, to know how the person would say it, if that person had the time and attention to put it, to do it in the best way that person could. So I think the sense of sounding like it's actually you is a very important thing. There is the there are then just a couple of other aspects of this. There is, for some speakers, a kind of music of rhetoric. Barack Obama was celebrated as a very good speaker. Almost nobody can remember any particular line he ever gave. And the line that people remember, not red states, blue states, but the United States, he never said. He said something different from that in his Democratic Convention speech. The reason he was impressive was it was a kind of musical performance. There was a melody to it. It was eloquence at the paragraph scale. And what I think is his best performance ever, which was a speech he gave at the Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina, after the gun massacre there. The theme was Amazing Grace. He wove that in conceptual terms to all the different meanings of grace. And then at the platform, he stood silent for about 20 seconds and began singing himself, Amazing Grace. That is something that people can aspire to, but he was, you know, wasn't is a great rhetorician. To thine own self be true, sounding like it's actually you up there talking is probably the most important thing. Also, I never use PowerPoint when I'm talking, but that's just me.
As you look to the future, how do you feel about where technology and culture intersect and where we're going? And a follow-on to that, what do you think will be AI's effect on our global culture?
On technology and culture, this seems to me like the endless frontier where Deb and I were with our little grandson, Jack, last month in Amsterdam for a week, just taking him on a grandparents and grandchild-only trip through Amsterdam. And we saw how the technology of the 1600s had transformed everything about Amsterdam with their art and their commerce and their canals and all the rest, their hydraulic technology of being able to keep the sea out of the town. And I think that the story of basically any decade in the last few thousand years is the way the technology of that time has affected the culture of that time, sometimes in destructive ways, often in ways that are hysterically warned against at the time. When I was a kid in the boomer era, transistor radios were going to be the end of pop culture. And I think it's a co-evolution of technology and culture where human society has become steadily more informed, more instantly informed. The highs are much higher than ever before. And so the challenge is to bring the middle up and to make sure things are as inclusive as they can be. But technology is a tool for that. For example, I've spent when I was in my teens and 20s and 30s, we go to many parts of the world where, although I spoke a lot of languages, I didn't speak their language. And being able to try to communicate was a big problem. If you think that real-time universal translation is now possible, that is something human beings have dreamt of for a long time. I think we're in a continuity of the endless interaction. AI, my sense is we've always been living in kind of an age of AI, that each new wave of technology, people say, oh my God, all these things that were not possible before. I remember the first time I could use a computer rather than a typewriter to write things, so I didn't have to retype the page again and again. And I think that my sense is that we'll see an accelerated version of what has been the human challenge for as long as human beings have been around, to use these tools in ways that are, on balance, more constructive and inclusive than they are the reverse.
Jim, thank you so much for your time. I very much enjoyed our conversation.
And Mariana, it's a delight to talk with you and be in touch with your audience.
Thanks for listening to the Esri and the Science of Our podcast. And thanks to James Fallows, who wrote the introduction to Jack Dangerman's book, The Power of Where. If you like this episode, please share it with a colleague.